It's the Burt Cohen Show. Magic of history. Yes, generally, one thing we learn from history is that we never learn from history. But if we do learn from history, it gives us great tools to tackle the issues that vex us right now. And of course, we've all heard about the fiscal cliff. What is it? How dangerous is it? What should be done about the fiscal cliff that allegedly is looming ahead of us? James K. Galbraith says, it's really not real. It's kind of a setup. But maybe this is an opportunity to really do something and make some policy changes. What would FDR have done? Let's look at a little bit of history as to what he did do. And the person we have as a guest today, I'm very pleased to have back with us on the Burt Cohen Show, David Woolner, who suggests that perhaps Obama should channel FDR. Perhaps that would be a very good thing. David, are you there?
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us. David Woolner is senior fellow and Hyde Park resident historian. Beautiful place there. I took a trip there at the Roosevelt Institute. He is also associate professor of history at the Marist College, and he's co-author of a number of books about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and is the author of the forthcoming book, Cordell Hull, Anthony Eden, and the Search for Anglo-American Cooperation, 1933 through 1938. Well, again, David Woolner, thanks for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. And President Obama and Congress are at odds, at loggerheads, on how to keep us from falling off the alleged fiscal cliff. We're talking about an article our guest today wrote for Next New Deal, very interesting stuff, entitled Obama Needs to Channel the FDR on the Fiscal Cliff. David, your article points out that the right is obsessed with the deficit. But it does seem that there's unanimity among Republicans and Democrats, really, that both are obsessed with the deficit these days. It's not just the right wing. In what ways is it wrong to obsess about the deficit?
Well, the real crisis in the country today, if you talk to many economists, is not the deficit crisis, but the jobs crisis. We seem to have put the cart before the horse. The reason we have such enormous deficits in large part, is because of the falling off of the U.S. economy. We've been going through a massive recession, the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. And with the fall off in economic activity, you have a fall off in revenue, both for the federal government, but also for state and local governments, which is exactly what happened during the Great Depression. And so there's a strong argument that's made economically that really stems from the economist, British economist John Maynard Keynes, that the best thing to do in a crisis like this is for the federal government to spend money, to employ people, to get people back to work. And that has a kind of what Keynes used to call an accelerator effect, mm-hmm. On the economy, to expand the economy. And as the economy expands, obviously revenues go up, tax revenue goes up, and the deficits go down. And, we've seen this. We saw this in the New Deal. We saw this in World War II. And instead of bringing about some huge catastrophe, as the deficit hawks would tell us,
right,
after taking on a great deal of debt in World War II, we had the largest period of economic expansion in U.S. history. So I think that they really got it wrong. And as I said in my piece, I think that President Obama might do well to focus on this aspect of this economic crisis rather than on the fiscal cliff.
Well, the politics today seem to be very, very different. We'll have to talk about that as we continue through this 55-minute discussion here. You know, today you hear a lot of people saying, get the spending under control. Spend, spend, spend. That's all we seem to do. And for a change, that seems to be resonating. And, you know, the deficit spending historically, in reality, you know, some people blame Obama alone, but deficit spending has continued since George W. Bush took office, and the debt as a result of the deficit spending has grown to $16 trillion. Is this not something to worry about? Are both parties, Democrat and Republicans, taking the wrong approach and accepting an incorrect framing of the issue? Is this debt, $16 trillion, not, you know, they say we're putting this burden on our children and grandchildren. What's your reaction to that?
Well, again, I think the reaction is that, you know, if you look at historically what has happened in the past, for example, during the Second World War, and in terms of deficit spending as a level of GDP, gross domestic product, we're below the level that we achieved in World War II, which was, you know, the government spent enormous amounts of money defending the United States against fascism around the world, and in doing so, borrowed enormous sums, and so the total government spending in the economy exceeded 50% of GDP.
Wow,
we're way below that now.
Yeah,
you know, if you look at economists like Joe Stiglitz or Paul Krugman, they would argue that what's really critical is to continue the stimulus spending. Of course, you don't want to leave massive deficits and debt unattended, but the way to attack it is to ramp up the economy. And with high unemployment, and actually persistent now high unemployment, which is really unusual in this country.
Yes.
The last time we had this kind of problem was, again, the 1930s.
Right.
The thing to do is to attack that root problem, that core problem, which is the lack of economic activity. And simply cutting government spending is actually not going to help. In fact, it's going to contribute to the continued shrinking of the economy, as we've seen with the European economies, particularly the British, who put in place an austerity budget. They're going through another recession as a consequence. So it's not that you want to ignore the debt, but the question is, how do you attack that problem? And you need to grow the economy. And the best thing to do in such a devastating economic downturn is to actually spend and stimulate. And the net effect of that over time is to increase revenues and ultimately shrink the debt problem.
You have to look a little bit more long-term than just the moment because, you know, in a way, it seems sort of counterintuitive. We're spending too much, so let's spend more. But you brought up the prospect of the specter, really, of austerity and some, you know, the it's so easy to say, well, the government's spending too much, let's just stop spending. How have austerity programs in Western Europe, they've been tried, they're currently being tried. How does that affect their economies? Does that help improve their economies and bring them back to health at all?
No, as a matter of fact, it has gone the opposite direction in Europe as a consequence of the austerity budgets that the governments have put in place. Their economies are shrinking, unemployment is going up. So it's counterintuitive in the sense that if you believe in the basic fundamentals of Keynesian economics,
right,
these policies are exactly the opposite of what Keynes would recommend. The other thing to keep in mind, thanks to the extreme rhetoric that we have now on the part of the conservative right, which really is a kind of fringe point of view.
Yes.
You know, these kinds of policies, for example, the New Deal-type policies, the idea of government stimulus for the economy, are regarded as left-wing, as socialist.
Mm-hmm.
And Roosevelt, of course, was attacked on the same terms in the mid-1930s. But there, nothing could be further from the truth. John Maynard Keynes was a capitalist. He loved capitalism. He believed in capitalism, and what he was trying to do was mitigate the extremes of capitalism or the excesses of capitalism or unfettered capitalism. He's trying to make capitalism work in a more consistent fashion. And in Roosevelt's case, when you think about the world that he was living in in 1930, saving capitalism means saving democracy, because the failure of capitalism, and that's the thing that the right-wing deficit hawks, kind of extremists, will not recognize. But there are periods in history when the capital system, when the free market system essentially fails. And when it fails, government has the responsibility to step in and try to do something to mitigate that failure. And that's exactly what Roosevelt was doing. He wasn't trying to do away with capitalism.
Not at all.
He was trying to save capitalism.
Absolutely.
And so we're in a very similar situation.
If you ever come across a bumper sticker that I thought of that says, "Bring back Keynes," would you send it my way, please?
Well, you know, again, I'm not trying to downplay or make light of the fact that we do have enormous debts and deficits, and that is an issue that needs to be addressed over the long term, as you say.
But
I do think that there's a kind of ideological extremism that has crept into the public discourse and has led to the media kind of mainstreaming this idea that the only thing to do in this crisis is to cut the spending.
Right.
And instead of asking the question, why aren't you doing more, they keep asking the question, why aren't you cutting more? What are we going to do about this? And that's where I think the public discourse has gotten off track, because really, in the Roosevelt period, and the generation that fought that war and lived through the Great Depression, they came to understand that the government had a fundamental responsibility to try to mitigate the worst excesses of unfettered capitalism. And they embraced this idea. And they embraced the ideas that were radical at the time, or considered radical by some, things like Social Security,
right,
unemployment insurance, the regulation of the stock market, which didn't exist before,
mm-hmm,
federal deposit insurance, so people could feel safe when they put their money in the bank. All of these programs and ideas were very, very simple, and all they were really trying to do was create a kind of set of rules, guidelines, under which capitalism could operate in such a way as to make sure that the average American didn't go through this kind of depravity again in the future.
Playing by the rules, what a concept. It does seem that many of today's economic extremists, who have absolutely taken over the Republican Party to their obvious demise, they want to do away with the rules. They want basically, instead of, we talk about a playing on a level playing field. There's no level playing field now. It's a game without rules. And as you point out, I mean, history never exactly repeats itself. Things are different, but there clearly are similarities. When FDR took office, there were, as you mentioned, basically no rules, no controls whatsoever. And the people in the middle who got, destroyed were really, really seriously hurt. And it does seem that many on the right today, and I have a hard time calling conservative, I don't know what they're conserving, nothing that I know of, but they're just hard right wing. I wonder what they would have said today, I can imagine, about some of those rules that FDR and his administration put in place, like the FDIC and things like that. They rail against people like Elizabeth Warren, who, it's great that she's now on the banking committee, and rail against the Dodd-Frank legislation that puts some controls on it. You know, a lot of the people today, the people in the military, for example, talk about the problem is entitlements. They have caused the spending problem, and that those things must be on the table, and they don't want to talk about military spending at all. There's got to be cuts available there and some regulation. Who was it? Was it the entitlements that caused the problem that we face today, or was it a lack of controls on the incredibly powerful, incredibly loaded in terms of money, financial sector? It seems like there's strong effort to control the entitlements, but you talk about controlling the finance industry. Horrors. We're talking socialism, Marxism. What do you think about that, Professor Woolner?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the same charges were leveled against FDR.
I'll bet.
during the mid-1930s, an organization was set up that was very similar to the Tea Party called the American Liberty League, which was funded largely by corporate interests and by a small group of wealthy individuals. It professed to be a quote-unquote popular movement, but in fact did not include large numbers of people. And they railed against FDR's New Deal. They called it socialistic. They said Roosevelt was taking the country down the path towards communism or socialism. They insisted that his programs were against anti-American and fundamentally undermining the U.S. Constitution. They had a huge emphasis on the Constitution, which is interesting because we get the same rhetoric today. And Roosevelt basically destroyed them by exposing the wealth that was behind the American Liberty League. The fundamental difference, I think, between now and then is that we've had the New Deal. We do have a basic level of economic security that the country has provided, that the average American has provided, and people have forgotten what it is like to live completely at the mercy of a powerful, wealthy interest, although we seem to be creeping back into that, disturbingly, back into that kind of situation if you look at some of the statistics. But when Roosevelt was president, 20% of all the school children in New York City were malnourished. People were starving to death in cities and in states like West Virginia, starving to death. There was a case of a child in Albany, New York, who died of starvation at his school desk. You had an unbelievably difficult economic situation, unemployment in places like Chicago and Detroit over 50%, stock market values falling by over 90% over the course of 3 years. I mean, the country was really unrecognizable. And the people had to turn somewhere. And what Roosevelt convinced the American people is that, and he said this on numerous occasions, he talked about the forces of wealth. He talked about the forces of greed, which he believed had brought the country to ruin, which is true. And he said against, and he called them economic tyrannists or economic royalists.
Yes.
And he said against economic tyranny such as this, the American citizen could only turn to the organized power of government. And people believed in this basic idea that government had a role to play, not in becoming a socialist state, but in regulating capitalism in such a way, providing these common sense safety measures that would, in a sense, level the playing field. Roosevelt was very strong in the notion that we had political equality, but it become meaningless, he said, in the face of economic inequality. And I think we're really approaching that today. You know, when you live in a country where, as Senator Saunders has pointed out, you've got 400 individuals who own more wealth than the bottom 150 million people in the United States, where 80% of all the new income generated between 1980 and 2005 went to the top 1%, where the average wage for a white male worker today, adjusted for inflation, is essentially the same as it was in 1978. You know, what you're experiencing is what happened in the 1920s, and that is essentially a maldistribution of wealth. The average American does not have the income to provide to purchase the level of goods and so forth that can sustain and grow the economy. That's what happened in the 1920s. The average worker was paid well, but just above the poverty line, paid well by historic standards. And the United States economy, the American industry, as you know, was tremendously productive. And we got to the point where the average person couldn't afford to buy the goods that the country could make. And you had a collapse of the market. It's not just the stock market crash. That's just the spark that set the whole thing off. There were these fundamental structural flaws within the economy itself, this maldistribution of wealth being one of the most important. And you have the same thing today. If we want to grow the U.S. economy, we need better paid workers, better educated workers, higher paid workforce spends more money, generates more economic activity, therefore more taxes, therefore more revenue, therefore less deficit.
It's amazing to me how the framing can change on that. I will tell you that there's a pizza store right near where this studio is, and he says, the problem is demand. There's a lack of demand. People, you know, his business is suffering. Ken's West End Pizza, I don't mind giving him a plug. Good Democrats. The demand has to be stimulated. And yet the people who are attracted to the Tea Party, and I think there are some good people who have reasons to be angry, they trust corporate interests, the powerful few, far more than they trust government. I think that's fascinating. And in doing the research for the show, I did read some words from Roosevelt where he said, "The oppressive sense of helplessness under the domination of a few which are overshadowing our whole economic life." I mean, that's exactly the sentiment that led to the birth of the Tea Party. Was it that same kind of feeling that led to the American Liberty League? That you know, did they, these right-wing plutocrats, did they manipulate that same feeling in the 1930s? And what finally woke the people up out of that to realize, hey, you know what, these plutocrats, you know, who want to, you know, the rich few who want to own everything and largely do now, that maybe government actually can be our friend. I wonder, how did that change? Did the people see through that, through the American Liberty League eventually?
Well, you know, I think that what the difference is the starvation. I mean, yeah. You know, you had such a dire economic circumstance. It was very obvious to anybody who was living through the 1930s that capitalism wasn't working, that the free market system had collapsed and had failed. And they were looking for an alternative or looking for a solution. And places like Germany, they ended up with fascism. Yes. and other countries in Europe and in Asia, they ended up with fascist alternatives to democracy and totalitarian states that eventually went to war with us. But in our case, Roosevelt said, no, it's not your fault, as he said in his first inaugural. It's the failure of the distribution of mankind's goods. You know, plenty is at our doorstep, he said in his first inaugural. But the distribution of that plenty has been distorted, has been ruined by the forces of wealth. And so he set on a mission to use government not to hand people money for no reason, but to engage in, you know, long-term structural reform, to put in place those kinds of measures that were necessary to make the banking and financial sector, for example, safe when you're dealing with Federal Deposit Insurance or the Securities and Exchange Commission regulation of the stock market. You know, before Roosevelt, you get more information buying a horse than you would about buying a piece of stock.
Yeah.
Under law. I mean, it was ridiculous. You didn't really have any, there was no requirement to provide people information about what they were buying in terms of their investments, and people bought garbage and by the millions. And so there was, and you know, greed is a powerful force. It's always present. So how do you manage that? Those impulses. That's what Roosevelt was trying to do. And people were desperate. You know, think about the labor songs. I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond rings. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give to me my job again. You know, people were desperate. They wanted work. They wanted the dignity of work. And they looked to Roosevelt and to the government to do something to try to provide them. And again, there's a lot of distortion on the part of the right. They say this was inefficient and so forth. But you know, look around the country. The New Deal built the economic infrastructure of this country, and I think you could make a strong argument that that was a very good investment. It was an economic investment. He didn't hire people to rake leaves and dig ditches. These were people that built, you know, the major highways in New York City, 8,000 airports, hundreds of thousands of miles of roads, you know, it's bridges, dams, public water systems, it's just and sewage treatment plants. So, and they didn't just hire the people who were digging and working unskilled labor. They hired the architects. They hired the engineers. They kept the skills of the country alive at a moment of great crisis. Of course, the right wing will say, well, the New Deal didn't work.
They're wrong.
Which is a fallacy because it brought down unemployment. This one of the largest drops in unemployment in the nation's history took place between 33 and 34 and 35. The average annual growth rate in the early 30s was 11%. If you look at China today, we say, wow, look at the Chinese economy booming along at 5, 6, 7%. Well, the early New Deal, it was for the first 4 years, average growth rate was 11%. The problem was that Roosevelt, like today, wasn't spending enough. They needed to do a lot more.
Right.
And they did do a lot more when we got to World War II. And then I like to say that World War II was a New Deal on steroids.
Hmm.
The government no longer had any prohibition about borrowing and spending and spent the kind of money that was needed to defend the country against this horrible tyranny around the world and put millions and millions of people to work.
The New Deal on steroids. Yeah, that's exactly how World War II worked. You're listening to The Burt Cohen Show. Our guest today is David Woolner, Senior Fellow from and Hyde Park resident historian at the Roosevelt Institute. We're talking about what Roosevelt would have done. It might interest our listeners for you to compare FDR's approach to the plutocrats, the greedy few that have the tremendous power. Compare FDR's approach to them compared to the main body of Democrats in Congress today and Obama himself. What, do a little comparison, would you please?
Well, you know, the political situation that, that Obama faces is actually much worse than the one that Roosevelt faced. First of all, because the makeup of the two parties was vastly different. Some of Roosevelt's strongest supporters were what we call progressive Republicans, and there were many of them. And some of Roosevelt's strongest critics, in fact, some of the harshest critics of the New Deal, were conservative Democrats. And by the way, the American Liberty League was launched by conservative Democrats. So the parties were not so monolithic. So the debate in the country over policy was a debate over conservative versus liberal policies. So we didn't get into this entrenched system where you can't vote for a good idea because it was put forward by the other party. Which is a complete absurdity that we have to face, unfortunately, today. The other main difference, I think, is the influence of money in politics. I'm not an expert on this, but I think it's pretty clear to anyone who takes a look at it that, both the Democrats and the Republicans are heavily financed by business interests. And the requirements of campaign financing really pretty much demand that they engage in an enormous amount of fundraising, and most of that money comes from entrenched interests. The right will, of course, scream and say that labor has a grip lock on the Democratic Party, but that's not the case.
Were it the case,
Both the Democrats and the Republicans receive a great deal of money from Wall Street and from financial interests in the banking sector and so forth. And from far more than, in the Democratic case, far more than they receive from the unions. So their political agendas are much, even on the Democratic side, are much more business, corporate, financial friendly than they would have been in Roosevelt's day. Senator Wagner, for example, who is the champion of the National Labor Relations Act, which is one of the most revolutionary pieces of legislation to come out of the New Deal, which said that as a worker, you have the right, should you choose, mind you, to form a union and engage in collective bargaining. Between 1933 and 1945, wages in the United States went up by 65% for the average worker.
Wow.
That's the worker that was the builder of the arsenal of democracy. That's the worker that built the American military, the largest navy, the largest air force the world had ever seen. That's the worker that laid the foundation for the largest period of economic growth that ever occurred, not just in the United States, but in history, between the mid-1940s and the early 1960s. So this notion that somehow we're spending our way and digging a hole that's going to lead us into some kind of sky-is-falling oblivion, I think, is a rhetorical tool that the extreme right is using very effectively, I might add, to push people away from really what are very common sense centrist policies. I mean, President Obama is not a left-wing politician. He's a very he's very much a centrist economic politician. He's He's fairly cautious, and the kinds of policies he's trying to put in place are not radical. And really, if you look at the New Deal, Roosevelt was very cautious. He was fiscally conservative, and as I said, some of his harshest critics are on the left who say, you know, he should have done so much more. If he had simply done much more during the course of the early to mid-30s, he could have brought the Depression to an end sooner.
Well, it may be the case, and certainly Roosevelt had those pushing from the left as well as from the South. There was Huey Long, which was certainly a force to be reckoned with, who talked about every man a king and had some fairly radical things to say. He, I don't know, left, right, whatever, but he was certainly a populist who died under mysterious circumstances, but we won't go there. You know, as you mentioned, it's not just the Republicans now, but Democrats in Congress are, you know, doing whatever they can to serve corporate masters, so it seems. And, you know, the election that we just went through was a big statement, real loud, real clear. We rejected the rule of right-wing plutocrats. We don't want the Mitt Romneys, you know, the selfish few to call all the shots. We want a republic, dare I say, and a government that actually serves the common good, something radical like that. And I don't remember the exact words. I'm sure you do. FDR said he wore the Republicans' hatred as kind of a badge of honor. Given the atmosphere where people rejected Romney and his plutocratic buddies, couldn't and shouldn't Obama do the same thing today? Is that possible? Wouldn't it serve them well to stand up to these guys publicly?
Well, I mean, I think there's something to be said for that. I think President Obama, by virtue of his makeup, his personality, has been very reluctant to adopt the same sort of rhetorical approach that Franklin Roosevelt adopted.
Yeah, and, that's for sure.
Which came out in spades, as you said, in the 1930s. When he was careful, by the way. He talked about conservatives. He talked about Republican leaders. He didn't assume that all Republicans would be against him, and he was absolutely right. Let's not forget the first head of Social Security was a Republican. Governor Wyandotte from New Hampshire.
Ah, yes.
He had major Republican support among progressive Republicans in the Midwest and in the West. Harold Ickes, the head of the Public Works Administration, mm-hmm. was a Republican from Chicago. Mm. Henry Wallace, first Secretary of Agriculture, who turned out to be one of the most liberal politicians of the 20th century, was a Republican.
He was?
Nominated.
Wow.
He became a Democrat later on. But, you know, so there was a strong Republican constituency for Franklin Roosevelt. You don't win the kinds of elections that he won without getting support from both parties. And as I said, some of his harshest, perhaps his harshest critics were Democrats, particularly in the South.
Oh, well, yeah.
But he took on these forces of wealth and greed, and he said never in the history of the Republic has a group of people been more united in their hatred for a candidate as they are united in their hatred for me, and I welcome their hatred. And that's not to 15 people, that's to 100,000 screaming supporters in Madison Square Garden. He came from a very wealthy background. He was part of this sort of patrician elite, wealthy elite of the United States, going back really over a century, well over a century. And so he was cut of the same cloth and was not afraid to call a spade and took this seriously and understood that these powerful forces would not give up without a fight. And they certainly tried to push him back, but he went straight to the people. He used the radio, he used the press very effectively,
yeah.
And made the American people understand that he was championing their cause in the White House, and that they had to use their government as a kind of tool of social and economic justice to right these deep-seated wrongs that existed in the country. And you know, this is again something we don't hear about today. I mean, if you look at this last census. There's a new category that they've come up with called the near poor. If you add the near poor to the poor in this country, you're talking about a third of the population. Roughly 50 million people are living in or just above the poverty line. And, you know, Roosevelt famously said in 1936, after all of these successes of the New Deal, he was thinking about further reform. And in his inaugural address, actually, in early 1937, he said, look at all these great things we've done, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not enough. And that's when he said, I see one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished. And he wanted to attack that problem even further. He wanted to go after that structural inequality in the country. Well, we're back to that if you think about the poor and the near poor. We've got roughly a third of the population living in or near poverty in this country. The word poverty almost never gets mentioned in the political discourse. There was a time, I'm sure most of your listeners will remember, when that was a major issue, not just for Democrats, but for Republicans. Why do we have this kind of poverty? What can we do about it?
Right.
Again, this obsession with this deficit, in my view, is completely misguided. It doesn't really address the fundamental problems that we're dealing with, and we'd be far better off to attack those root causes of the deficit. Which really have to do with the fact that we have a maldistribution of wealth in this country, that wages are too low, that people aren't earning the kinds of incomes they should be earning for decent jobs to sustain the free market economy. The wealth has been absconded by the top 1 or 2% of the population, and that is really a non-sustainable situation that really has to change if we're going to make this capitalist system work.
Yeah, it's something other than capitalism, and certainly, as we all know today, Roosevelt was, you know, was in a wheelchair, and it seems to me he had more backbone than Obama, who's not in a wheelchair. He stood up to that, and it served him well. I don't know why the president and Democratic members of Congress can't see that there are these vast numbers of people, as you say, one-third of the country at or near poverty. I think that would serve them well politically to be visible champions for that and to take on, you know, the plutocrats that have destroyed this country. I mean, it served Elizabeth Warren well. And, you know, talk about that. I don't know why more people don't do that. And
well, I think there's a couple of reasons. First of all, I think for the President Obama, you know, his unusual background, his growing up essentially coming from two different worlds, his father coming from Kenya and so forth, and mm-hmm. his mother, you know, coming from Kansas, being a kind of mainstream mid-American.
Yes.
You know, it's bred in his bone to try to be a force of reconciliation between African-Americans and white America, for example. And he's very, very passionate about reconciliation and trying to bring people together, as he was as a community organizer, and that's certainly to be admired. So his makeup is not one that would lead towards confrontation. Roosevelt, in many ways, as one historian friend of mine said, was a great divider. I mean, he is wealthy, but he came from that class, and he kind of understood where they were coming from. I don't think President Obama has quite the same luxury, although I think he could do more of it, and I think he would be effective if he thought through a careful way of pointing out that this fundamental inequality is not only unjust but is non-sustainable. I think in the case of Congress, it's just inexcusable in terms of the Democratic Party in particular. But again, I think what the problem is again, you go back to the influence of money in politics, and yeah. the fact that thanks to the disappearance of just the manufacturing industry in the United States over the past three, four decades, so much of our economy now is dependent on the financial sector. You know, our fathers and grandfathers, it was a rare person that worried about the stock market. That was a very small percentage of the population, and it was a small percentage of the U.S. economy. I think the last statistic I read recently had the level of the financial sector in the U.S. economy now up over 40% from 15 to 20%, say, 20, 30 years ago. So they wield enormous influence because they are such a large part of the overall economic activity. But as Joe Stiglitz would say, that's not the real economy. You know, that's not the people that make cars or manufacture things or produce all the goods that we need. But the financial sector has enormous sway.
Yes.
And now, because they are such a large segment, and they have enormous sway with the politicians because they are, in a way, dependent on them for campaign finance.
So is it the case that, Roosevelt was more able to take on this financial sector, but it was a question, again, I believe in his Madison Square Garden speech, spoke about, who has the legitimate power? Does the government, is the common good, does that interest take precedence over the greed of a few? We're talking with David Wilner, senior fellow at Hyde Park, resident historian, about a bit of comparison between Roosevelt and Obama and what can be done now. And again, I believe it was Halloween, actually, 1936, where he spoke at the Madison Square Garden and talked about that in his first administration, the plutocratic powers, he didn't use those terms, were kind of angry. He had said that they had met their match. But in his second administration, it was an intention at the time, anyway, that they would meet their master. How might it be possible, Professor Wilner, that today, where the financial industry is so much bigger and so much more powerful, is it still possible to somehow shape things and make them work for the common good? It seems that it has gotten the other way around now. Is it still possible to do that?
I think it is possible. I think what President Obama and certainly the Democratic leadership has to do, first and foremost, is to make people understand just what they're up against. And maybe they don't have to use quite the fiery rhetoric that Franklin Roosevelt used when he said, for example, the field open for free business was more and more restricted. Private enterprise, indeed, became too private. It became privileged enterprise. And he even quoted the paraphrase, the Declaration of Independence, when he said that, men were no longer free, not able to engage in the pursuit of happiness because of this economic inequality. But I think what's been missing is a drawing out of that fundamental fact. I think people are nervous, fearful, frightened. I think that's what's given rise to some of these extreme ideologies. And I think what President Obama has not been willing or able to do for a number of reasons is to really take up that cause and to make people understand that what we're dealing with is a basic structural flaw in the U.S. economy, that these forces of wealth and power are essentially distorting life in the United States, and that this is a moral question as well as an economic question, and that this kind of inequality is simply not sustainable and really is fundamentally unjust. I mean, Roosevelt also said at one point, we always knew that greed was bad morals. We now know that it's bad economics.
Yeah,
so he needs to hammer that message home. And I've been encouraged slightly by his apparent unwillingness to back down on the question of raising taxes on the most wealthy Americans. I think that's a fundamental issue here. But he could go further, and certainly the Democratic leadership could go further, in a sense, essentially talking about a kind of us versus them attitude, which is what Roosevelt embraced. And the us is the American people against a very few powerful elite who would like to essentially abscond with the nation's wealth and who are absconding with the nation's wealth. And, in Roosevelt's day, they called it socialism to have that kind of attitude, and he basically said that's nonsense. What we're trying to do is build a just society. And I think that those issues of justice, of economic justice, have been downplayed. It's all about growing the economy and building the middle class and this sort of thing. But it's really a moral issue at base when you have this incredible distortion of wealth. When CEOs, their incomes have gone up by 600-1,000% since the 1980s, and the average worker is earning the same thing he's earning in 1978. I mean, that is just not a sustainable economic system, and it's an immoral situation. It's unjust. It's economically unjust. And well, I think that that's what they really need to address.
Well, okay, it's as you and Bernie Sanders and lots of other people point out that it is, you know, incredible unequal distribution of wealth, more than any major country on earth right now. And, you know, okay, it's not very nice. And the right wing talks about the politics of envy. So it's very difficult to say, you know, it really is the huge population versus the very, very few plutocrats. You know, it's not nice. It's not real moral. But so what? I mean, in what ways is this bad for the economy? And how does this fact, or does this fact relate at all to resolving back where we started talking about the fiscal cliff?
Well, absolutely. Because again, as I said at the outset, you know, what's fundamentally wrong with the United States is this problem of a maldistribution of wealth, where you have the exploitation of labor, where incomes of people, the average American worker, are not going up. People are living on borrowed money. I mean, if you look at the generation that racked up all this credit card debt in the last 30, 40 years and housing debt, you know, basically what they were trying to do is sustain the same standard of living as their parents. But their parents lived under a highly unionized, higher paid wage force where decent jobs, pensions, things like this were a part of life. All of that has been stripped away. We now, people are personally responsible for their savings. And Americans do embrace this idea of the rugged individual often. But the reality is, if you look historically, there's been tremendous government intervention in our history all the way through, from building the transcontinental railroads and other economic infrastructure and so forth. And so, you know, there's no reason why they couldn't embrace the idea that government should ensure that wages are appropriate, that taxation levels are appropriate, that educational opportunities are there for all Americans, not just for people at the high end of the income scale, and that we could create a country where social mobility was something we could be proud of, where people really could be better off than their parents. That seems to have disappeared.
Yeah.
And those economic indicators are there. They're real for anybody to see. And even magazines, as conservative magazines like The Economist, have pointed this out and said that this is they're very disturbed at the destruction of the American meritocracy and this creation of a kind of plutocracy in the United States. So, but for some reason, the American people haven't been able to get a clear picture of what's really right in front of them, and I think that what should happen and what didn't happen in the campaign, but what should happen in the future, is a much more stark and harsh description of the economic realities that exist in the country. This class system that we're living under, we pretend we have a classless society, but it's not true.
Yeah,
and it needs to be articulated. And if you believe in a class society and you want it, then you can support these kinds of policies. But this economic inequality is real, and it has profound impacts on the entire country. Roosevelt said 70 years ago that if you want to get rid of the debt and deficit, you got to raise wages, because if you want to grow the economy and make people wealthier, you'll get more revenue. That's the way to attack the problem of the deficit, and that's the way to make a healthier economy. But what we tend to do is say, oh, well, we don't want to be taxed, you know, we're all on our own, and somehow we're
right.
All going to make it in this, you know, we're all going to be a millionaire someday, which is, as you know, complete nonsense. If you look statistically at people that grow up in poverty, the chances of them getting out of poverty are very small.
Yeah.
And so we need to break down those barriers through better education programs and so forth.
Well, and as any, you know, success, there's that old saying, you know, government should run like a business. Well, any business knows you have to invest to prosper. And that's, you know, what has happened before. And if when people, a lot of people have more money, guess what? The economy does better. And you talk about taxes. People are, you know, oh, we don't want to raise taxes. Well, what is the reality about what FDR did to the then super rich? What was their level of taxation? How did they get hit by Roosevelt?
Well, Roosevelt believed in progressive taxation, and there was opposition to this. But he put in place much higher tax rates than we have today, although people would be surprised. I mean, the average American wasn't paying all that much in tax back then. But there were rates that were up above 50% for the very wealthy, and those, particularly in the Second World War, increased. The net result of these policies was not economic ruin, but massive economic expansion.
Yes.
Because he invested in the country, and people had good wages, they had good jobs, and you had a pro-union, pro-wage kind of outlook on the part of the government, although the government didn't actually initiate that. I mean, that came from the labor movement itself, but the idea was that people deserved a living wage, a decent wage, and that was kind of fundamental to this concept. And with better wages and with higher incomes, as I said, there was greater economic activity and greater economic growth, not just for the middle class and people at the bottom, but people at the top as well. So everyone did better, as President Clinton put it so well in the Democratic Convention recently.
Yeah, he did. Again, we're talking to David Wilner, Senior Fellow and Hyde Park Resident Historian at the Roosevelt Institute. And, you know, I talk to a lot of people, of course, as we all do, and I have found that Republicans, you know, not the real right-wing Tea Party-manipulated Republicans, but a lot of Republicans, if you talk to them for a little while, would like to see a massive jobs program. They recognize that our essential infrastructure is badly decayed and that we should have a New Deal type jobs program. A lot of Republicans support for that. I sense a huge support for a jobs program. Now, we do hear that, oh, well, government might be picking winners rather than just the free market. But why is this not happening? If there's so much potential support for that, I don't get it. Do you have any insight into that, Professor Wilner?
Well, I think it's not happening again because the conservative right has made a decision to obstruct those types of programs. Before the election, they made a decision to obstruct those kinds of programs in part because they wanted President Obama to fail, which is highly irresponsible on their part.
Sure.
So millions of people continue to suffer, probably needlessly, in the face of that obstructionism. So again, political ideology has taken precedence here, and party discipline has taken precedence over the well-being of the country as a whole. We are in a dysfunctional political situation, unfortunately. There are many, many factors here that we could talk about. I already mentioned the influence of money in politics.
Right.
I talked about the increasing influence of the financial sector. You have a media that is largely,
a shill?
Misinformed or not really professional. You have right-wing media and left-wing media that tends to want to hear what it wants to hear.
Yeah.
Professional journalism, where people ask intelligent questions, such as yourself, is pretty rare these days. And so the public is largely misinformed. You also have what I call the mainstreaming of the extreme. I mean, they love to bring out people from the extreme right or the extreme left and give them a mouthpiece so they can have lots of sparks and arguments. And this is essentially driven by a corporate desire on the part of the media companies to maintain their ratings and their income.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's very little sense of public responsibility in terms of the media.
Yeah.
So the public is at the mercy of this and gets very little real information about what's really wrong with this country. I think at a certain point, hopefully people will begin to wake up. You're beginning to see cracks emerging now with organizations like McDonald's and Walmart where you're seeing attempts at unionization and so forth, because being paid a non-livable wage is rather absurd in a country as wealthy as the United States. But that's what's happening in this country. We have tremendously depressed incomes across the board, and it's a structural problem.
I got to ask one final question. You would know this better than I. I heard a tale of A. Philip Randolph, who was head of the Brotherhood of Pullman Porters, a largely black organization. He met with President Roosevelt, and the president said, you know, he wanted higher wages, better working conditions, whatever. And Roosevelt said to him something like, I'm with you, I agree with you, now make me do it. How you may know exactly what he said, I don't, but I'm thinking that that kind of sentiment is still applicable today. We, the people, have to go out in the streets and make the government do it.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I also think that thanks to the lack of articulation of these ideas, you know, for example, the Occupy Wall Street movement was very interesting. The Tea Party movement is also interesting, but they are not articulating a kind of vision for the future. Tea Party is very negative and kind of destructive in its approach. The Occupy Wall Street movement has identified the 1% as a problem, but not really articulated some of these problems that we've talked about. So again, I think it would be helpful if we had people at the top, people in positions of public respect and leadership that would say, you know what, the United States is in trouble, and we cannot continue in a society where you have these kinds of enormous inequalities between the people at the very top and the rest of the country. This is fundamentally unjust and fundamentally unsustainable, and it's time to fix it, and the only tool to really ultimately fix it is the government. And a recognition among the people, as Roosevelt said many, many years ago, that people need to remember and never forget that government is ourselves and not an alien power over us. So, you know, if we want the government to do, to fix these fundamental flaws in our country, we need to stand up, as you say, and demand it.
Always very insightful. I recommend highly the website Next New Deal. I believe that's what it is, right, Professor Wilner?
That's correct.
Next New Deal. Very, very inspirational. Always great to talk to you. David Wilner of the Roosevelt Institute. Thanks so much. And wouldn't it be nice if we could learn from history?
It would be nice. All right. Thank you, Bert.
Thank you. And here is Loudon Wainwright III about Roosevelt.
Mr. Roosevelt, you're the hero of the hour. We sent you on to Washington, bestowed on you full power. This country is a vast domain. It's the finest spot on earth. We've worked and struggled, fought and won every conflict since our birth. On to victory, Mr. Roosevelt, we'll need one mighty strong. Now that you're our president, we know it won't be long. Folks are happy once again, yeah, singing his glad song. Mr. Roosevelt went back of you, 120 million strong. So cut expense, tear down the fence between supply and demand. Put folks to work, don't let them shirk, let farmers keep their land. They don't need cash to cut a dash, there's faith in those we trust. And when they say that they will pay, they will not go and bust. All the victory, Mr. Roosevelt, will need one mighty strong. Now that you're our president, we know it won't be long till folks are happy once again, singing this glad song. Mr. Roosevelt went back and you 120 million strong. Onward, noble president, we have our faith in you. When we see your smiling face, we never can be blue. Smile and pray, work hard each day, and soon things will be bright. The sun will shine, we'll all feel fine, everything will be all right. On the victory, Mr. Roosevelt, we'll need one mighty strong. Now that you're our president, oh, we know it won't be long till folks are happy once again, singing his glad song. Mr. Roosevelt went back of you, 120 million strong. Let's look into the future now, many years from today. There'll be another president to help us on our way. A younger man with darker skin will soon be called upon. And history will repeat itself and folks will sing this song. On the victory, Mr. Obama, we'll need one mighty strong. Now that you're our president, we know it won't be long till folks are happy. Singing his glad song. Mr. Obama went back of you 300 million strong. Mr. Obama went back of you 300 million strong.
Loudon Wainwright III.